Have you ever wanted to play the perfect tabletop game, where story beats run smoothly, and there's no awkward pauses between dice rolls? Yeah, me too. But since that's impossible, I did the next best thing, and novelized my Witcher tabletop game to showcase the story in its cleanest form. The result is this podcast. I'm Jacob Gerstel, and this is Tales from the Witcher. Part audiobook, part actual play, part serialized adventure, and a whole new way to vicariously enjoy tabletop games. Welcome to the world of The Witcher, where monsters roam freely and the continent is once again at war. If you were hoping to follow the plight of Geralt of Rivia, however, I'm not going to be doing that. Instead, I offer you the story of a not-so-merry band of degenerates who are making their way across the continent. So sit back, relax, and enjoy. The End of All Things. 3. In the moment, it can be difficult to recognize when one makes an error. Yet, lifetimes are pockmarked with hundreds of such moments, like uneven cobblestones running down a straight or crooked road. One such error took place at the Academy of the Silver Towers over a century ago. Of the many rules that Rectoress Findebear laid down to her pupils at the Academy, and there were many, students enjoyed reciting them to each other in a mocking tone from the safety of their rooms. Stand up with a straight back when addressing another elf. Only wear starched blue robes when in lecture. Never speak ill of someone behind their back. She only spoke of three with the solemn reverence of an ironclad law. The first was that her students were not to practice magic outside of supervised training, unless she said otherwise. Her pupils typically ranged between the ages of 10 and 30, mere children in elven years, far too young to understand the destructive power they wielded. The second was to not leave the Silver Towers after dark. It was foolish to expect young sorcerer and sorceresses in training to stay cooped up in their rooms all night. Rectoress Findebear allowed them to wander the city, for it was safe enough, but they were not to go into the forests beyond its walls. This was mainly to avoid the headache of tracking down missing students, rather than protecting them from monsters in the dark. The forests around the Silver Towers were quite tame. Students who were caught breaking either of these rules were kept from training for 2 weeks, a punishment that these ambitious magic users feared most. The third rule was that students were never, under any circumstances, to enter the garden on Rose Hill. This garden was located at the top of a gently sloped hillock north of the Silver Towers, and was free for all to look at, for the garden boasted a beautiful array of rose bushes that were tended daily by gardeners. The roses were in full bloom all year round, and seemed untouched by the elements. Elven families enjoyed sitting on the grass of Rose Hill, basking in the sun with wine and cheese, and admiring the garden, but none of them ever tried to enter it. They couldn't, even if they tried. A magical barrier, invisible to the eye, forcibly repelled interlopers. Rectoress Findebear made this point very clear to her pupils. This third rule is the most important to keep in mind, for look now at these two young elves sneaking over the Silver Tower's northern wall. It was the middle of the night, and the guards were at the height of their inattentiveness, mainly waiting for the shift relief to come. The leader of the pair, when no one was looking, stepped off the parapet and slowly walked through the air until he reached the ground, as if he conjured up an invisible staircase to keep him from plummeting. This young elven sorcerer was 17 years old, and he had been training under Rectoress Findebear for 7 years. His name was Ethramel Ontred, and he, like so many sorcerers before him at that age, felt confident in himself and his power. This was not unearned, Ethramel thought, as he watched his companion stutter-stop his way down these spell-made steps, where he had glided moments earlier with sure feet. His companion, Eric, came from an outlying farm and was found by Rectoress Findebear after he accidentally set a cornfield on fire as a child when a droning bumblebee startled him. He was 2 years younger than Ethramel, but shared his love for boundary pushing. Already they were breaking the first two ironclad rules in service of breaking the third. Along they trotted to Rose Hill, and made their way up to the garden hemmed in with magic. Ethramel explained to Eric how he planned to get past this garden's defenses. He had seen the gardeners walk through the barriers with ease, and each time he felt a spike in power burst from them as they crossed the threshold. Therefore, all he and Eric had to do was summon up all their power right before touching the barrier to break through it. Thoughts of failure or doubt never entered Ethramel's mind. He was popular at the academy, with many friends. He often spent long nights walking the streets of the Silver Towers with a dozen students, laughing and playing games. He made his parents, Della and Matthias, proud with the pace at which he learned to control and channel his power. Younger students would come to him and ask for help on a particular spell or wording. Ethramel was usually happy to oblige, though he often found it hard to explain something he didn't fully understand himself, but had a knack for. He was a middling student academically, but was told by many adults, for more than 5 years now, that he contained a keen intellect and talent. Therefore, Ethramel had convinced himself he just didn't take to studying despite his great gifts, and therefore didn't need to worry about his exams. Rectoris Findebear found him more than once lounging in the school's courtyard when he should have been in class. Ethramel often got lectured, and sometimes was barred from training, but he took it all in stride. After all, he had a keen talent and intellect. He was told as much. And this was to be his crowning achievement. He would enter the garden and pluck a single white rose from a bush and show them to his classmates back in their rooms. He pictured the expressions on their faces. Ethramel walked to the very edge of where he thought the barrier was. He could feel his fingers and toes tingle from the energy it gave off. With Eric watching, he summoned up all the power he could muster, coating himself in it like chainmail, and stepped through. He felt resistance akin to wading through waist-high water, but he was not knocked on his ass as he had seen done to many others before. He had passed through, tired and shaking, but unharmed. Eric whooped, and Ethramel held a finger to his mouth to indicate silence. The garden looked plain, as far as gardens went. A few well-kempt and winding pathways showed off rose bushes on either side. Ethramel found the closest one sprouting with white roses, making sure that Eric could see him. He knew his friend would spread the tale far and wide. And here, Ethramel was handed the first true failure of his life. For when he pinched his thumb and forefinger around the rose's stem, careful to avoid the thorns, and gave it a tug, the flower stayed in place. Ethramel felt a seizing nausea roil through his body in an instant, and he blacked out. When he came to, he was just outside the garden. Eric was gone, but Rectoress Findebear was there. She sat cross-legged next to the young sorcerer, staring at the rose garden. If she noticed Ethramel had woken up, she didn't show it. Ethramel groaned. He no longer felt nauseous. It was just the typical body aches that came from expanding too much power.
"What happened?"
Ethramel asked, sitting up and crossing his legs to match Rectoress Findebear. "What happened is your skill fell short of your reach," Francesca said, breaking her gaze and turning to her pupil, after two attempts that had her double-taking back to the garden. "Not to mention breaking a host of rules I set down quite explicitly to even be here."
"Yes, yes, I'm aware of all that, Rectoress."
Ethramel raked his fingers through his shoulder-length hair. She was speaking in what Ethramel called her stone tone, much to the amusement of his peers. Francesca was nowhere to be seen when he said that, of course. It was a riddle of a tone, both welcoming but distant, lively but calm. She always used it when she lectured him. Ethramel was used to lectures by Francesca, and considered it a necessary evil to stretch his talents beyond what she taught.
"What I mean is, what happened in there?
I tried plucking up a rose, and it held firm. Then I..."
"Passed out," Francesca supplied.
"Yes, you're lucky Eric had the sense to come straight to me and share what happened. I sent him back to his room, of course."
"Would I have died if I lingered in there?"
"What?
No.
For all the praise you get from the elves in the city, sometimes you show a stunning lack of sense. If you lingered in the garden, you would have suffered a splitting headache and felt like you had the pox. But if anyone was in danger of dying in there, I would have ensured none but me could pass through that barrier. Find some perspective, Ethramel. You're hardly the first student to break into the garden."
"Then why is there a garden at all? There are a dozen gardens around the Silver Towers. Why is this the one people can't enter? Francesca Finderbear was quiet, and the sounds of crickets and scurrying critters filled the air. Do you know who Aelorin is? She asked.
Of course I do. Every elf grows up hearing of her.
This was true, but the projected confidence in Ethramel's voice masked the fact that he knew very little of the elven revolutionary. He never had much interest in learning about important people, especially when they were long dead.
Yes. Well, 100 years ago, she came to the Silver Towers. She was on a recruiting march, preaching revolution against humans to anyone who would listen.
Francesca looked again at the Rose Garden. That was the very spot she chose to make her grand speech, rallying hundreds of young elves from the city to join her cause.
Ethramel understood now. And the Rose Garden was planted in her honor after she died, he said.
Rectoress Finderbear gave the Bearess a nod, indicating she only agreed with the second part of that assessment. This Rose Garden was indeed planted when the White Rose of Sheroed died on the battlefield, but it was not in her honor. It was out of necessity.
Ethramel didn't understand, but didn't say so.
Certain places carry more significance than others, Rectoress Finderbear explained. Often there are places where acts of great importance are carried out. Aelorin convincing those young elves to follow her to their death was an act of great importance.
Ethramel agreed that sounded like a significant piece of elven history. His mind was already working on how he would amplify what happened tonight when he told his friends, to make even his failure seem like a grand triumph.
Those places carry a mark that can't be seen, Rectoress Finderbear said. Aelorin herself didn't know she created such a place when she left the Silver Towers. It was only after her death, and the deaths of all her followers, that Rose Hill took on significance. Overnight, it changed from a representation of hope and freedom to one of foolishness and despair. Whiplashing changes can create a dangerous source of negative energy, one that is not welcoming to any who step foot near.
It curses the land itself, Ethramel said. Now that sounded interesting.
Yes, my foolish pupil. So we decided to plant a rose garden on the very spot Aelorin stood. I need not tell you the symbolic significance of roses in this instance. Imbued by that symbolism, the roses act to contain the negative energy. It makes the land habitable again.
It didn't feel safe when I tried to take one of the roses.
That's because, after 100 years, the roses have grown hearty. They barely need tending. But all of that power, in a continuous push and pull, can hurt lesser minds. That is why I went to such lengths building a barrier, sectioning off a part of our home that can no longer be enjoyed.
I did well, though, Ethramel couldn't help but say. He smiled. I summoned enough power to bypass your barrier.
Yes, there's no questioning your talent. Rectoress Finderbear stood up and held out her hand. Let's go. We're heading back to the academy, and you'll have a month without training because of this stunt. This was where Francesca Finderbear made her unknown error. For she, despite knowing Ethramel's strengths and weaknesses and limitations, also believed what the elves of the Silver Towers were saying. That Ethramel was different, smarter, more powerful than his peers. Francesca was hoping that, by taking the time to explain Aelorin's actions and far-reaching consequences, she was teaching the importance of exercising restraint and patience, especially when you wield power and influence. And indeed, were Ethramel a little older and experienced, he likely would have taken that very lesson away. But he was still only 17. Infallible to the fantasies most teenagers spend an inordinate amount of time dwelling on. In Ethramel's case, this fantasy took the form of awe, in that someone could be so significant that the very ground they once trod upon still bears their mark. The White Rose of Sheroed must have been remarkable. Since that night, Ethramel took more interest in elven history, particularly Aelorin. And, over time, her revolutionary ideas germinated in his head, until he could see no other way of looking at the world.
4. Jeremiah had seen elven cities, of course. More than half of the human cities in the north, Oxenford and Novigrad included,
were built upon the bones of ancient elven cities, after its original people were run out by humans. Often, these cities only retained a few marks from their original inhabitants, an elven tower amidst human buildings, or a sturdy portion of white-stoned wall, or a complex sewage system running below the streets. But Jeremiah Keller of Edirne had never seen an elven city so closely preserved to its original state. Elven architecture favored rounded edges on their smooth buildings, often white with silver trim. The ground was made of circular white stone, immaculately cut and placed in neat, alternating rows. Large swaths of the city teemed with greenery, from towering trees and overgrown gardens. Yet, marks of humanity lingered everywhere. Edirneans, Jeremiah's people, had occupied Dol Blathana for over a century, and the elves could not erase Edirne's mark within 5 years. Wooden square shops squeezed between the rounded towers, with sloped and thatched roofs. Shaded awnings made of cheap timber lined the streets, casting a patchwork of shadows on the white stone. Parts of the city's foundation was torn up for no clear reason. And the elves of Dol Blathana, to their credit, were not against using the structures left behind. Elves shilled their goods behind run-down merchant carts that were parked all over Edirne. A group rolled dice beneath a shaded street. Youthful-looking couples entered and exited the wooden shops with cheap knick-knacks. The only thing missing from this scene was children. As Jeremiah waited at the gates of the city, he tried to find a single child or baby, and could not do so. The silver towers looked like it could comfortably house 10,000 inhabitants, but the number of elves walking the streets did not reflect its size.
"How many people live here, Ethrimel?"
Jeremiah asked, after the sorcerer was done talking to the guard at the entrance of the city. "What?" Ethrimel said. He looked around the city and took a deep breath.
"In the Silver Towers, or all of Dol Blathana?"
"Both, I suppose.
Probably 1,000 elves live in the Silver Towers. Maybe 2,000 for all of Dol Blathana."
"Only 2,000 elves in the entire duchy?"
Jeremiah said.
"I'm sorry, were you under the impression the elves were a populous race?" Ethrimel snapped.
2,000 elves, to stand against the Wild Hunt and Gutter Rebellion? No wonder Colden was confident enough to lead a small strike force towards the Silver Towers. He might well be able to conquer it on his own, if he's as formidable a sorcerer as he seemed.
"Aiden here says there's an open common room at the Golden Poppy we can stay at," Ethrimel said, motioning to the guard. "Take the road down to the first well you see, then take a right down Market Street. You can find it from there."
"Where will you be going?" Silva said.
"To see my old rectoress, the current duchess of this place," Ethrimel replied. "It'd be best if I do it alone."
"Do we need any escort?" Zevo asked, eyeing Aiden the guard. Ethrimel spun on his heels to face Zevo.
"No, you don't need an escort just because you're Dwan in an elven city. Dol Blathana has always welcomed outsiders. Always."
Ethrimel shook his head and looked at each of his companions in turn.
"That being said, don't expect a royal welcome either, especially with that monstrosity roaming around."
Ethrimel jabbed a finger at Dottie's golem. The witch wrinkled her nose and rubbed Yenmo's shoulder.
"Now bugger off before the gods kick us out for causing trouble."
"What if we're to—" Silva started.
"Just go!" Ethrimel hissed.
"Come on," Tabek said, shepherding Jeremiah and the others. "Let's not stand around gawking like a bunch of tourists. We've work we need to do." Jeremiah cast a glance back at Ethrimel as they walked away. The sorcerer had already turned his attention to one of the silver towers in the distance. He was shaking.
"Not my concern,"
Jeremiah thought, turning away. They passed by the elves dicing in the street. They stared up at the outsiders, whispered to each other, and gathered up their things. They quickly walked down a side street, away from Jeremiah. He heard a window close behind him, and saw an elven shopkeeper shuttering her doors. A she-elf was putting on an impromptu concert on a small stage a little down the road. She had an audience of 6, but she cut herself off mid-verse when she caught sight of 3 witchers, a hobbling craftsman, and a witch riding a golem. Her audience craned their necks to stare, and they silently watched Jeremiah pass. He heard the she-elf's ballad continue when they were more than 20 paces past.
"What a grim place," Jeremiah muttered.
Doves flew overhead. they reached a white stoned well that marked a three-way intersection, continuing straight and branching to the right. A wooden post stood near the well, pointing to the street on the right. It was Market Street. Jeremiah watched two elves pull on frayed hempen rope, pause at the sight of the newcomers, then pulled faster to secure a cracked wooden bucket sloshing with water. The elves detached the bucket from the rusted hook, looked at Dottie's golem, and continued up the road.
"Can we take a break here?" Jeremiah said.
The sun was directly overhead and burned his scalp.
"Walking takes more effort than it used to."
"Sure," Tobek said. He helped Jeremiah sit on the lip of the well and placed his crutch within arm's reach. The others sat around the well, too. Upon closer inspection, Jeremiah saw cracks running up the white stone, and some of the mortar holding it together yielded to a probing poke. Jeremiah gave the frayed rope a few test tugs and heard a squeak from the mechanism below. Out of curiosity, Jeremiah braced himself against the well to peer down it, and he felt the stone buckle in his hand. For a nauseating second, his balance capsized, and he thought he would tumble headfirst into the well. Fortunately, Crit Drummond braced the craftsman with his arm and straightened him out.
"Easy there," Crit said, patting Jeremiah on the back.
"Thanks,"
Jeremiah sighed. He grabbed his crutch, despite his heavy breathing.
"This could do for some maintenance. Sorry, I'm ready to go now."
They walked slowly down Market Street. It was the liveliest street they'd been on so far. A few dozen elves were milling from shop to shop, mostly acquiring the essentials. Food, flour, lumber. The shopkeepers were in short supply of these things, judging by the meager portions of each the elves carried. They received more stares and closing doors. The sign to the Golden Poppy Inn was so cracked, faded, and worn down, it looked like a rotting circle. Its front window was broken and boarded up. They all stood outside the inn for a second, trying to ignore the stares they were issued from passerbys. "Yenmo's gotta stay outside," Silva said to Dottie, for obvious reasons. Dottie nodded.
"Yenmo can stay in the stable, out of sight. Let the innkeeper know she means no harm."
"I'll be joining her," Letho said, looking around. "Less people see me, the better."
"I'll wait out here with you," Crit said to Letho and Dottie.
Jeremiah did not comment on the three most conspicuous people choosing to wait outside. Instead, he walked to the closed door and tried to open it. The door would not budge. The craftsman knocked three times and waited. He was rewarded with the sound of three locks unlatching and a droop-shouldered elven man peering at them. He blinked, but did not say anything. Jeremiah cleared his throat.
"We'd like to rent some rooms for the night."
"Ah," the elven innkeeper nodded slowly.
"For you lot, I've only got a common room available. That should fit you all comfortably."
"Sure,"
Jeremiah said.
"May we come in?"
The lobby was modest, but boilerplate. A painted landscape that Jeremiah felt he'd seen at 1,000 inns hung on the wall. A yellow and white carpet that was fraying from use. And Jeremiah could hear the telltale creaking overhead, indicating movement on the second floor.
"Seen trouble recently?"
Zevo motioned to the boarded-up window at the front.
"What?"
the innkeeper said, taking his place behind the run-down front desk and squinting. Then he shook his head.
"No, that window's been broken for 3 years.
3 years? And you haven't fixed it?" Silva said.
"What's the point in fixing it?" the innkeeper replied.
"Nothing's permanent in Silver Towers."
"Guess of Lyria said, this city's been around for over 1,000 years. The innkeeper nodded.
"And it'll probably be around for 1,000 more. But that ain't the permanent I'm talking about. Say I fix that window tomorrow. Then maybe the day after that I've got to pack everything up and head into the Blue Mountains again. Why waste the effort?"
No one argued with the innkeeper's logic. Jeremiah rented the common room on the first floor for the mall, which amounted to a semi-private space with 3-foot-high walls marking where it began. Anyone passing by could see them. Fortunately, the square room was equipped with a stone fireplace and a few chairs to sit in. The innkeeper handed each of them a bedroll to sleep on. They had barely settled into the room before Zevo started doubling back.
"Where are you going?"
Jeremiah asked. "To get wine from the market," Zevo said. "I need a drink."
That'll do it for this episode of Tales from the Witcher. This podcast is written and produced by Jacob Gerstel. The Witcher novels are by Andrzej Sapkowski, The Witcher games are by CD Projekt Red, and The Witcher tabletop RPG is by R. Talsorian Games. The music is by Eric Matias at soundimage.org. Be sure to leave a rating and a review, and to spread the word of this podcast far and wide. You can follow the podcast at TalesWitcherPod on X, or at talesfromthewitcher.buzzsprout.com. Thanks again for listening, and I'll see you again next week.